This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Open-heartedness. What does that term mean to you? Does it have cultural, spiritual, even religious connotations? Some people say magical things happen when you open your heart. Has that ever occurred for you? We've got three guests waiting to share their view. One heads up a Virginia-based institute that studies cultures around the world. Another, a religious scholar, has examined references to open-heartedness in early Judeo-Christian traditions. And the third, a former therapist, teaches the use of heart energy to work what sounds like an awful lot like magic, although he calls it psychokinesis. Bound to be a fascinating conversation, and you can just sit back and listen. But if you've got an insight to share, you'll be welcome to join our discussion of open-hearted living, too, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Open-hearted living is our focus today. What does that phrase even mean? Is it something you try for in your life? Is it something people can do easily? Does the part of the world you live in make any difference in how easy it is? And why would you want to try to live more open-heartedly anyway? Our call-in line is open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Later in the program, we're going to meet a clinical psychologist who's taken the concept of open-heartedness to levels most of us have never imagined. After some 30 years of treating patients in a traditional setting, he now travels the world teaching people to use what he calls heart energy to create some pretty miraculous transformations. But first, we start with a religious scholar and a different psychologist. Catherine Lowe is a professor of religion as well as college chaplain at Mary Baldwin College. Craig Sheely is a professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University as well as executive director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute. Craig, great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Nice
Reverend
to see
Lowe,
you.
Great to have you here for the first time.
Thank you
both for making time for us. So, Dr. Sheely, you first. Now, much of your work involves promoting understanding between different cultures across the globe. So what does the term open-heartedness mean to you? And is it different here in the U.S. than it is in your experience in other parts of the world?
The term open-heartedness, I've always sort of been fascinated by terminology and the meaning of that, how we measure it, what the implications are. When I hear a term like open-heartedness, I first think of the, sort of the big five personality factors. Openness is one of those big five factors.
The heart this is in classic psychology?
Yeah, personality theory, essentially, in research. The heartedness element of that, open-heartedness, sounds at one level and maybe a bit superficially to be sort of a sub-component of that literature, which looks at openness in general, and then openness in terms of kind of affective responsivity, sort of the capacity to feel interest, inclination to attend to that in other people. So at that level, I guess I would refer to open-heartedness as sort of the capacity and inclination to be open to one's experiences, emotional experiences, open to difference in oneself and others, to be excited by that rather than to sort of meet those experiences with a sense of apprehension. So to your question of whether you see differences around the world, yes. I mean, I think that there are general trends that can be identified that characterize different cultures from our own in terms of, generally speaking, in terms of a greater or lesser degree of open-heartedness, as I've attempted to define it right there. But I guess my fundamental point would be that there's a lot more variation within cultures and contexts than there is between them. So on a construct like open-heartedness, as I've attempted sort of feebly to define it here, you're going to see a lot more variation within a country across the spectrum of high and low open-heartedness than you are going to see between two different cultures and contexts.
Katie Lowe, much of your work, your scholarship has been on Christian biblical texts and even Jewish texts preceding Christianity. And it's my understanding that the term heart is something that you've looked very carefully at in those texts in a number of different languages.
Mm-hmm. Biblical Hebrew and Biblical Greek. The dichotomy that we often have today of the heart and the mind often being in opposition of one another sometimes, the heart being the emotional seat and then the head being the intellectual seat, that is not present in biblical tradition when one looks at specifically the use of the word heart. And the word heart in biblical tradition does not mean the pumping organ that functions in the human body. What the word heart means in Hebrew tradition that carries on over into the New Testament Greek tradition is that the heart is the seat of human emotion, intellect, and will. It's the hidden part of oneself. It's often translated as conscience. It's translated as being human. It's just translated in many different ways because it means all of that. So that dichotomy in biblical tradition disappears.
So in your view, Katie Lowe, if I was living in a particularly open-hearted manner, what would that look like?
Well, biblically speaking, anyway, the one whose heart sees God, or the one that who is open to seeing God sees God. So the hearts that are hardened are the ones that cannot see the divine working in the world around them, are not spiritually aware. In my opinion, that's what open-hearted means.
Your view, if I'm tracking this correctly, if I was living in a particularly open-hearted manner, at least according to the ancient Hebrew texts, I would much more likely be having divine experiences. I would be in a place where connecting with God would be much more likely.
Yes.
I knew she was going to give me one word. Craig, help me out with this. If I was living in a particularly open-hearted manner, what would I look like? And you know me well enough to know how much different that would be.
You're very open-hearted in my experience, Tom. As George Carlin said, or somebody said, you scratch a cynic and you find an idealist. So I think there's a beating heart for sure there. Yeah, I mean, I see people who live, and it's not in many ways dissimilar to what Katie has just said. When I think of it in a clinical context or a cultural context, people who live in an open-hearted manner, from my perspective, working in therapy, working with students who are in training to become psychologists, or in travels through IBAVI to different cultures and contexts.
I love it when you say that.
What's
you know I'm going to stop you every
What's
time
that?
You say.
Oh, I've been. Sorry. That's right. Yeah, broke a cardinal rule.
There are people
rule.
Driving along 81
right. Yeah, right.
Who've never heard you before.
Okay,
and he said, "Did he just
I've
sneeze
been.
In a special language?"
No. IBAVI, International Beliefs and Values Institute,
okay.
Or IBAVI. Thank you. Sorry for forgetting.
Did I take
that
you
rule.
Completely off track?
No. Not at all. I'm still there. So you know, open-heartedness from that perspective across all those contexts, people who are open-hearted, in my experience, are those who are able to have a full range of affective experience, and that includes emotions that are positive, happy, as well as emotions that are not, that are sad, angry even. Folks who have a full capacity to pay attention to what's happening inside them emotionally.
So, Craig, it sounds to me like Katie is saying, if I'm open-hearted, I'm more connected to God. And what I'm hearing from you is, if I'm open-hearted, I'm more connected to the world around me.
Well, and that's a really fascinating point,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? You know, in my world, I have many friends who are atheists, of course, and agnostics. I'm not an atheist. I'm very open to these possibilities. So I don't know that I would really see a dichotomy. I think it really depends on what we mean by open to God. You know, if by God.
But both of these traditions here, it sounds like I'm hearing the term greater connection. to whatever that I'm being connected to, but I'm not closed off from my world if I'm living more open-heartedly.
And the world of others. Mm-hmm, and the world of others. Mm-hmm. So self and other.
Okay. So joining us now by phone is the author of the new book, Inner Vegas. Although for the full flavor, I ought to mention the subtitle too. So it's Inner Vegas, Creating Miracles, Abundance, and Health. The author is a retired clinical psychologist, Dr. Joseph Gallenberger. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom, and hi, Katie and Craig.
Hey, Joe.
Hi.
So how do people go about creating miracles, abundance, and health? And in your view, Dr. Gallenberger, what does open-heartedness have to do with the process?
What I've found is we are looking to raise a very high, fine energy and focus it and then let go and trust for the result we are desiring to happen. This might occur in energy healing and manifesting something in your life. And the thing most scientifically studied where it would happen is what we call psychokinesis, the ability to affect matter with your mind. So that would be things like bending metal and plastic, growing seeds in your hands in a few minutes, affecting dice and slot machines to bring in the inner Vegas part. What we found is an open heart, in my sense, meaning the highest love one can develop, including transcendental or ecstatic love states, the more powerful the state of love that seems to be, the more powerful we are able to affect physical matter reality to create the miracles, abundance, and health that is referred to in the title of the book.
And my understanding, Joe Gallenberger, is that you have had some very practical experience with the things that you just mentioned that are going to sound kind of bizarre to some people listening. So I'm going to ask you about specifics of that in just a moment. But you also mentioned the term, I was struck by this, Joe, psychokinesis, and then said people think of that as affecting matter around you with your mind. But if I understood your book correctly, Joe, in my previous conversations with you, you believe that what's really going on is people are affecting things around them with more than their mind, with what you would call their heart.
You got me there, Tom. The standard definition you might see would be something like affecting matter with your mind. I feel we're affecting things as much or more so with our, in this case, heart energy. We use the mind to set intention and maybe to decide a little bit about how to go about it, but then the mind kind of needs to move out of the way. And we use our heart and our spirit really to create the kinds of effects that I've been seeing.
Now, you were a fairly normal guy, as I understand your biography, up until a little more than 20 years ago. And then you met a fellow in Virginia by the name of Bob Monroe. And some stuff happened for you.
Yes.
You want to tell us a little about that?
Bob Monroe was a businessman, very practical guy. And he did have a lot to do with sound for radio shows and things in the 30s and 40s. And within that, he began to explore the potential of sound for sleep learning and found that if you could hold somebody right between sleep and awake, that tended to be the sweet spot for learning things. And as he did that, he began to have what now is known as out-of-body experiences. He'd feel vibration, feel his consciousness, leave his body, and go traveling. He could turn around and see his physical body still in bed, for example. And I had had some out-of-body experiences as a kid, so I may not have been as normal as you try to describe them, though I think it is a pretty normal state. And so I was attracted to Monroe Institute and found they had a great technology for achieving very profound meditative states very quickly for the Westerners particularly.
Well, Joe, we're going to hit the break in a second. I want to give you an opportunity to continue this narrative. It's also my understanding that shortly after you discovered some amazing things for yourself by going through some programs at the Monroe Institute, you then went and did some further schooling in psychokinesis at Princeton University. We're going to hear all about that in a bit more than 1 minute. Dr. Reverend Catherine Lowe is both college chaplain as well as faculty member in religious studies at Mary Baldwin College. Dr. Craig Sheely is both director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute based at Mary Baldwin, as well as a professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University. Dr. Joseph Gallenberger spent some 3 decades as a therapist in private practice. Today, he travels the globe teaching the heart energy lessons contained in his new book, Inner Vegas. We've asked these 3 people to come from their different disciplines and perspectives, tell us about their concept of living more open-heartedly. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So, Joe, we got interrupted a little bit by that break. You were telling us about going to the Monroe Institute, having some wonderful sort of mind-expanding experiences there. And I understand that after something happened there, you decided, from the point of view of a scientist, which is what you consider yourself, to do some more study of psychokinesis.
Yes. So again, when I was up at the Institute, found that the type of energy healers describe having when they're doing energy healing, that is, their hands are often very warm, their heart is feeling very open, they feel connected to earth energy and also highest of spirit, and they bring through very strong healing forces. I also found that same energy pattern was there, if used in a different way, could affect, say, the roll of a dice, so that you could roll 7 sevens in a row if that was your intention. And that really intrigued me because that is easy to study, a little more easy than energy healing at that time, because we know statistically how often dice should come up by chance as number 7. So looking around, I got a grant to go to PAIR, Princeton Engineering Anomalous Research Lab, to look at psychokinesis experiments. And so, for example, they had me with my energy make the height of a fountain bubble higher for 15 minutes, then lower for 15 minutes, leave it alone 15 for control. And this is all behind the glass, so you couldn't touch the fountain or blow on it, send energy to, you know, air by it. And I got results that were highly significant, and then we went on to an experiment where you affect what they call a random number generator. It's picking ones and zeros, much like you would do a heads and tails flip of a coin. And so it should come out 50-50, if you will, if it's random. And in this case, this experiment called ArtBreg, they had 2 pictures of kitty cat and a pyramid, and you were supposed to think with your mind or your heart energy or whatever you could do to bring out one of the pictures. So I'd be looking at the screen, thinking how much I love kitties, and going, here, kitty, kitty, and that picture locks out into clarity. So to do that, you would have to affect the random number generator. And again, there, I think it was 30,000 to 1 by chance. So by the time I left Princeton Lab, 3 or 4 days after I got there, as a scientist, PK was unknown to me because I saw enough proof in what I did, but also reviewed their literature, which some of their experiments had 12.5 million trials, very well controlled, very reliably done by very reputable people. And it suggested that indeed we can affect matter using our energy in ways that the usual culture does not think is possible.
Dr. Joe Gallenberger, I want to ask you to emphasize, or at least allow me to make sure I understood something you said a few moments ago, because if I'm recalling correctly, some parts of your book, you certainly underscore this. I think what you said, Joe, is that after you left Princeton, psychokinesis was a known to me.
Yes.
In other words, rather than just thinking that maybe this was possible or wanting to believe that it was possible, you walked away with no doubt in your mind that it was real.
That'd be correct, Tom, both scientifically looking at it, but also when you have the experience, you can actually feel this shift of consciousness. You know you are connected. It's a different kind of truth than scientific truth. And basically the data the machine gathers merely confirms what you already have experienced, that you've been in complete connection there and had influence.
So let me see if I can connect the dots here and then bring our other guests back in to discuss this whole concept of living more open-heartedly. The Monroe Institute, which is based in Nelson County, Virginia, south of Charlottesville, was a place that you first went to in the early 1990s when Bob Monroe was still alive. You established a relationship with him. You experienced some of their programs where you use this audio technology with headphones on to take you into deep states of meditation. As I recall from the book, Joe, one of the things that you found is that when you got into a certain state and you touched someone who had a headache, they reported that their pain went away.
That's
and
correct.
You also found that in some, I guess they had a game night in one of the programs there, in some of the games that you did, that if you achieved a certain state where you felt very open-hearted, among other things, the same sense of your hands warm, the sort of healing energy state that reflected positively on people's headaches, that when you rolled dice, you found that much more frequently than chance would predict, the dice would come up the way you wanted them. Am I on track so far?
Yes, you are, Tom. That's a pretty good description.
So as I understand it, what you decided at some point was to continue experimenting with this, and that you chose as one of your primary modalities was the use of dice because you wanted other people to have an easy way to get to the point where they could prove to themselves that psychokinesis was real. That if they got into this open-hearted state and they started repeatedly rolling dice where the odds against the numbers that were coming up were tens of thousands to one, they would eventually get to the point where they would have to say to themselves, something about this mind-heart psychokinetic connection is real.
Actually, initially I was a little more selfish. This idea of being able for humans to have the ability to do psychokinesis just intrigued the heck out of me. And I wanted to get a black belt in PK, if you want. Yeah. So I looked around for where I could go, because I couldn't go back to Princeton every week and be studied as a subject there. So I looked around, and the best place I could find to practice this was Las Vegas, because the dice are guaranteed to be neutral, the odds are well known. Slot machines also have that random number generator in a pseudo-random number generator fashion that experiment I mentioned Art Reg had with the kitty cat and the pyramid. So if I could go and be successful, I could pay my staff back at home and I could learn more and more about this. So I went out and individually interested at that time, but what I found is my own ability to manifest positively in my life, my own healing of things within my own body, like cat scratches and things, was accelerated. And so after a while, I decided this would be very useful for other people. And at this point, I've run 65 what's called Intervegas Adventure Workshops with about 15 people in each one, teaching this to people over the last 10 years or so.
Dr. Reverend Lowe, we have a man with a PhD in clinical psychology who for three decades ran a traditional doctor relationship type practice, telling us that heart energy can make matter move. You told us that old biblical texts say heart energy can connect you with God. I'm curious, Katie, how you're reacting as you listen to what Joe is saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking out of that biblical tradition, I think that would be a step too far, according to the text that we have from biblical, that one would be able to manipulate exterior matter with an open heart, because the only being that could do that is God, and that God is the one that has all of that control over the world, and that humans don't. the tradition within the biblical literature is that one is connected to the divine through an open heart. But that doesn't mean, in at least as the tradition speaks, it doesn't mean that they could, one could manipulate matter in that way. That would be considered witchcraft or other things that within the tradition would turn their back on and say it's not allowed.
Craig Sheely, in all your travels around the world, including the eastern parts of the world, you deal with people who have religious beliefs where what Joe is saying would not be considered contrary or abnormal.
There certainly are within aspects of Hinduism, for example, there certainly are people who report similar kinds of phenomena to the kinds of phenomena that Joe is describing. And I strive in my life as a researcher, as a theorist, as a practitioner, a trainer, to be open-minded and open-hearted. And my own bottom line, I guess, standard is if we have some degree of agreed upon methodology that we're using, that's implemented by a trusted source and is subject to external scrutiny by people who don't have a vested interest in one outcome or another, and we have the kinds of findings, if we do, that Joe is reporting or that I have seen and heard in other parts of the world, including this part of the world, then I am open to trying to understand what the phenomena are that we're experiencing and observing. And I encourage my colleagues to strive toward that open-minded, a skeptical, critical-minded, but also an open-minded framework in relation to these kinds of claims and these kinds of purported phenomena.
Craig, is open-heartedness a good thing?
Well, from a standpoint of human functioning, I think it's crucial. If I loop back to the definition that I attempted to offer at the beginning, which I don't think is all that dissimilar from what Katie offered, or in some ways from what Joe is trying to articulate, when I see people who suffer and struggle in a clinical context or just in life, oftentimes it's because life history, experience, context, sometimes culture, has impacted upon them in a way that open-heartedness is not a state that they can find themselves in. And the implication of that for them and the people around them can be profound in terms of unhappy relationships, a lack of awareness of self, can affect career, it can affect life, what people do at a behavioral level. So even aside from the level of this discussion that Joe is sort of articulating, there certainly is an argument, and not just from an anecdotal clinical standpoint, from a literature standpoint, that open-heartedness, being open to one's emotional world and that of others, is crucial to healthy, adaptive functioning.
You said, I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe.
Concur with that, Tom. Craig, we're talking about a fairly esoteric use of open-heartedness here, but and that, I think, is what happens with the training. Basically, you could look at psychokinesis as a classical conditioning model. When you're at a dice table, within 2 seconds, you will see feedback of whether your heart is open and you're grounded and you're feeling one with everyone. And when you're in that state, you'll get rewarded with money. If you go into greed, fear, ego, you'll get punished by withdrawal of money. So in a reward-punishment sense, you're classically being conditioned to a more open-hearted way of living. When people leave there, they go home and find, you know, the money in the Vegas thing is not the point. It's the feedback device. They find when they go home that they have begun to train themselves to be more open-hearted in relationships, in business, and other situations. And that leads to greater intuition, richer relationships, etc., which... So one of the biggest victories I have is when people say, a year after this workshop, I'm much happier. And the people around me are much happier, and I feel more powerful and effective in my community. So it is the psychokinesis to me is a training paradigm to be able to use this as a life skill, and it's a very profound life skill to have.
And one of the places, it's not the only one, but one of the places where you do this training is at craps tables at a casino in Las Vegas. And it should be noted that, as you point out in your book, you purposefully have people, the dozen or 15 people who are in one of these weekend courses, making very small bets at a dice table. I guess part of that is to lessen the amount of fear involved, and mostly to get the practice in what you call those neutral situations, where you know that the dice are supposed to fall a certain way by chance, and you can compare what's actually happening compared to what's supposed to be happening by chance. Am I correct in all this, Joe?
Yes, we do workshops in other venues now, including Monroe Institute, where we, because a lot of people will not set foot in a casino to learn these kinds of things. We have a home study course. But they all involve this idea of real-world quick feedback and many meditative exercises designed to quiet the mind and open the heart. We use some of the hemisync I mentioned. We also use very beautiful open-hearted music where people just naturally respond by feeling greater feelings of love. We talk a lot about gratitude, other states that tend to open the heart, and even technologies such as HeartMath, just as simple as putting your hand over your heart, can bring your awareness more out of your mind and into your heart space. So,
well, Joe Gallenberger, I want to let you know that I've been checking around about you. I mean, after I read your book, I called some people who were familiar with the Monroe Institute, and I said to them, can you find me someone who's been through one of Dr. Gallenberger's training programs, either here in Virginia or anyplace else in the world? Now, the advantage of this was that I end up connecting with people that you, Joe, did not know I was talking to.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, all I heard was rave reviews. I mean, one woman who told me about her experience with you is a retired financial advisor, another a medical doctor who recently left the military service but continues to work primarily with veterans. Another is a former network reporter for the CBC. Not people you might expect to be easily convinced that psychokinesis is real or that they could learn how to do it themselves. And I don't know if any of them are going to call in today. They certainly have been invited to. But what each of them told me privately is that you are the real deal. Still, I got to believe many people listening are going to be awfully skeptical. Mm. How do you deal with that skepticism?
I think skepticism, with the true meaning of the word, being open-minded and willing to look at things, but not being gullible and not being over-trusting, but trying to be objective. I think skepticism is a wonderful, healthy attitude to have about this, about our government, about many things. So I celebrate skepticism. There are some folks at times that will claim to be skeptic who really have an agenda to never look at the data, never do their own experiments, but to proclaim this a priori is invalid. And that
we're about to hit another break. We'll be back in a bit more than 1 minute. But to you listening, I'm curious, whatever your view of Joe Gallenberger's work, this general concept of open-heartedness, do you find it intriguing? Do you think it could lead to good things? Joe Gallenberger's newest book is titled Inner Vegas, Creating Miracles, Abundance, and Health. He's with us by phone. Here in the Insight Studio, clinical psychologist Craig Sheely, as well as religion scholar Katie Lowe. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Our topic today, open-hearted living. And if you've got thoughts about it, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Whether you've got questions or opinions to share about this fairly, for most people, unusual message of open-heartedness being related to psychokinetic abilities that we're hearing from Dr. Joe Gallenberger, or what we're hearing from religion scholar Katie Lowe, clinical psychologist and cultural scholar Craig Sheely about the general concept of what open-heartedness could mean in our life. 888-WMRA talk by phone. You can also reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And Katie, you had a question for Joe.
Yeah, and it's I have a hidden agenda a little bit, Joe, in terms of a comparative religious idea. But the question I had for you was to elaborate on that quick feedback that you were talking about when people are engaged in psychokinesis. You say that quick feedback helps them, and maybe just elaborate a little bit more on how that helps and how that works.
Sure, Katie. Again, what we do when we go out to Vegas, we would send a preparation manual so people know the game ahead of time a bit. And we spend a whole day meditating together, forming very nice bonds of love and appreciation. When we go down the table, then we're sort of all on the same team, all rooting for each other. We're sending energy to the person with the dice, almost like you would in a healing circle. So we're seeing them in their highest and finest and just sending pure energy to them, and we don't think numbers whatsoever. The person who has that capability to receive that energy, then as they roll a dice, what they will tend to find is if they move into ego, meaning feelings of fear, of performance, being impatient, being irritable, whatever that might look like, as an ego state, what will happen is they will fail at the psychokinesis, maybe even do negative PK, get the exact opposite what they wanted. When they move into unison with all that beautiful energy being sent to them, they often experience mild ecstasy states. They may see a crown of gold over the table and angel wings sprout. They may feel like the table's surrounded by fairy dust. They may feel deep love from an ancestor present with them, or they may feel great love for the group. Whatever they're doing, they're moving out of just their own self-preoccupation into a feeling of something greater than themselves. And when they do that, the dice tend to roll as we are hoping they will in terms of hitting our intended targets. And when that happens, they get rewarded with chips that can be turned back into money. Again, that might start to go really well. Let's say you had the dice and you had a target of five and you roll five fives in a row. At some point, your ego is probably going to come back in and go, this is impossible. I'm standing out too much from other people. Who knows? And at that point, you can feel yourself slip out of that loving state into an ego state and you begin to get punished. The people next to you can give you a hug out there, what have you, get you back into a nice heart-based state, and you see it go successfully again. So the feedback's very quick, and you can keep fine-tuning it. You don't have to be perfect and do it forever, and the dice will reflect where you are at that moment. Does that help?
Yeah, it sounds like it's very communally connected, that yes. you establish a community first. That these people are not strangers, and that that connectivity then helps with that feedback?
Yes, very much so. There was a woman who wrote a book looking at psychokinesis through all different cultures and looking for commonalities, and she would say that altered state of consciousness was essential and being in touch with something greater than yourself. And then, you know, several other points, but those were the two key things. So it is a way that you can move out. You can move into a religious feeling, a human communal feeling, many different ways. But it seems like it's important to get out of basically your own head and your own preoccupation of how you're doing as an individual.
One, you know, there are a couple points, I guess, questions, points, comments. Joe, for all of my colleagues who will be listening skeptically and sort of wishing I wouldn't possibly be open to the kind of frame that you're offering here, I guess there is a huge literature, isn't there, on The human capacity to fool ourselves and to be fooled.
Yeah.
And I think I offer this only as a thought, that I think the degree to which you can, and maybe you do this, but recognize that literature a lot out of social psychology, for example, front and center, and acknowledge the legitimacy of that for decades of work. People have done this kind of work.
Yes, well, I do
okay,
see
good.
That is very legitimate.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons I like to have the statistical reference of what DICE might do that I can look at. To give you an example, I went one time in the casino, and my goal was a royal flush in hearts, which I know is 160,000 to one on a slot machine. And I sat down, and some people found me at a time I didn't want to be found. I just want to be by myself. And I had that split-second option, and I opened my heart fully and said, sure, sit down with me and join me. And the third pull, I got my royal flush in hearts. That is impressive on the day, but what I would need to see as a scientist is those kind of things repeated more than once. And at this point, with over a decade, I've seen it repeated many times. I think there's a great book for your colleagues that you speak of, a book called Science and Psychic Phenomena, The Fall of the House of Skeptics by Chris Carter.
Okay.
It's the best description to me of the power politics behind folks wanting to not allow this to be looked at. And it has a good summary of the studies in PK. Going back to your point about the research on how we can fool ourselves, I would definitely want to see, you know, the placebo effect and other things taken care of. So if somebody says to me, and I'm not downing this, but if they say, I have this great crystal, and if you hold it, you'll feel better, and the person holds it and they feel better, that's great. But I don't know if it's suggestion or something objective happened, and I would want to find the smoking gun of why that's making them feel better. We're now beginning in this PK area to actually be develop some machines that seem to be measuring the energy that's used by shielding all kinds of known energies, such as electromagnetic. And because it's in pilot study form, I don't want to quote which university it is, but it's a reputable university coming to Monroe Institute when I do the MC Squared programs with the psychokinesis in it. And we're getting nice data at the 10,000 to 1 by chance level when he cross-analyzes through four different programs. So I think in the next 10 years, we will have more of a causal chain on how this works.
Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, Craig Sheely, Executive Director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute, Katie Lowe, Professor of Religion at Mary Baldwin College, plus by phone, retired clinical psychologist Joe Gallenberger, author of the new book, Inner Vagus. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. And Craig, I don't know how many times you've been on this show. It's been at least half a dozen. But you and I have gotten to the point where we know each other well enough that you know something about my personal health challenges. And you've listened to some of the interviews that I've done about that here, and the sort of brutal conditions I grew up with, the diagnosis of PTSD as a result of that. One of the mystery health conditions that came up a few years ago, on top of many others, was really severe headaches that I have with me most of the time. And I've noticed lately, even before I read Joe's book, that sometimes if I get into the right state of meditation, or I do the right amount of exercise, or even sometimes with some kinds of non-narcotic medication, the headache will go away. And when it does, I suddenly feel kinder and more compassionate toward the world around me. So what I'm wondering is that just me, or is it that I am less kind and compassionate towards other people and have my heart more closed down when I'm in pain, which I am much of the time, and then suddenly the pain goes away and that changes, and is that something that other human beings experience?
Yeah, I mean, a main point of connection, not only with your tale, and for listeners, I encourage them to hear that very powerful story you shared of your own life. Yeah, I guess my experience now, I've been doing this kind of clinical stuff for, I don't know, 20-some years, is that the very kind of description that you just described of various illnesses or conditions, why I am open to what Joe is saying, as well as the tradition that Katie comes out of, is that I am fascinated by the many ways that the body, in its fullest sense, mind, emotion, body, spirit, if you will, how those aspects of who we are interact together, and the role that we inside ourselves can play in terms of affecting the kind of change, Tom, that you just described, as well as the role we have with one another to try to facilitate healing and growth and understanding. So my plea would be not to get caught necessarily on very legitimate skeptical reactions people may have to the claims that Joe is making. Investigate them according to good established methodologies, but reflect on the deeper issues, which I have seen around the world, which have to do with how we see ourselves. Who do we see ourselves as being, as human beings? Who do we see ourselves as groups, as cultures? How do we resonate to these differences among us? What capacity do we have for that? And then how does that manifest in our policies, for example, whether it's internal educational policies or healthcare policies or external in terms of foreign policy? What's the connection between our capacity to pay attention to be aware of phenomena within us at a very deep level? And then how does that work itself out in the larger world in terms of how we see ourselves and others and what that means for us in our lives?
Katie Lowe, you're not just a professor of religion.
No.
You're also a college chaplain and have been for many years. So I'm curious, this question I have in my mind of when someone's in pain, it's harder for them to be open-hearted or kind or compassionate towards others. And when the pain goes away, it's easier. Is that something that you agree, disagree, have no opinion about?
Well, to further what Craig was saying, it sounded to me that you were presenting, Craig, a holistic picture of humanity, that the dualism that we inherited from the Greeks, you know, mm-hmm. the spirit, flesh mm-hmm. dichotomy, the dualism there, or the mind-body, that those dualistic ideas, and perhaps Joe can speak to this too, are can be damaging.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and I think Tom's to answer directly Tom's question, at least offer a thought on it. Sure, I mean even from a Maslowian standpoint, if you're dealing with physical pain,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to be able to attend to other needs in self and other. So there's a direct relationship, I would argue. I don't think an absolute linear or deterministic relationship, but there is a relationship between just being in a state of physical pain and occupied with that and how that occupies psychological space, which makes it difficult.
I would broaden it to psychological and spiritual pain as well, depression, anxiety, and we do have some aids. So if we can, using technology, teach somebody to meditate deeply through coaching, psychotherapy, teach them to focus on different things. My brother committed suicide. One of the things that helped me along through that process was continually looking for beauty in nature and beauty in music and things. And the beauty itself was very, very healing. You know, my main message in Inner Vegas in my workshops is that we're miracle workers living in a miraculous world, and we can indeed shape our personal futures and the world's welfare. But it takes work. It takes clearing our limiting beliefs, raising our heart's energy. And within that, There's sensible approaches. I know a little bit of Tom's history enough to know that he's taken some very sensible approaches, and I wish him every blessing and benefit from those approaches. But it can be a cycle, especially pain creating depression. Mm-hmm. Now you have psychological things. Now you doubt God's goodness to you. Now you have spiritual things on top of it.
Joe, the headache pain's coming back, so I'm going to cut you off.
There's Tom.
And one of the reasons that I asked this, even though that we're now at the end of the program, is, Craig, you and I have talked about this before. Some places in the world where people have very little and yet they seem so connected,
yes,
and
Calcutta,
so happy.
In
our society, yeah, where we seem so mistrusting, yes, and disconnected from each other, I guess that's a topic for another show.
It's a great topic.
Our guests have been Catherine Lowe, college chaplain and professor of religion at Mary Baldwin College, Craig Shealy, clinical psychologist who heads up the Virginia-based International Beliefs and Values Institute, plus by phone a former clinical psychologist who now travels the world trying to persuade people to put more heart energy into their lives, Joseph Gallenberger. Once again, Dr. Gallenberger's new book is titled Inner Vagus, Creating Miracles, Abundance, and Health. Thank you all so much for making time for us.
Thank
you.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get to that page, you'll find links to more information about all our guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.